Motorways are becoming smarter to help traffic flow smoother. When traffic conditions are good, the national speed limit will apply. But when traffic becomes heavy, the speed limit can be reduced.
So, if you see a lower speed limit, slow down and stay within it.
By following speed limits, we'll all be doing our bit to keep the traffic flowing. Highways England, making motorways smarter. For more information, search for Smart Motorways online.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome to Let's Talk Tribe. This is your host, Jason Lukart. It's Wednesday night this week, not the usual Thursday. The Indians just finished beating the Orioles, taking two of three of them in a big series. The win tonight puts them in front of the Orioles in the wild card standings. They're three games back of the Rays right now, with Tampa Bay playing later tonight, so it'll be either 2.5 or 3.5 out. And, yeah, so 74-65. I checked FanGraphs, their standings update within a few minutes of the end of every game, and they're now projecting 87 wins for the Tribe and giving them a 20% chance of making the playoffs. And I'm pretty sure, and my guest tonight might be able to confirm this, I'm pretty sure FanGraphs standings do take into account the schedule the rest of the way, which for the Indians after this series is pretty light. The Royals are the only winning team they play the rest of the way. So after losing a couple in Detroit over the weekend, I feel pretty good right now. You know, like I said, that the schedule is going to get easier. And if the bats get going, the Indians definitely still have a run in them, I think. Anyway, I want to get to my guest because he's someone I'm excited to talk to, and I think you'll be excited to hear from. He's known to Indians fans, at least Indians fans who read Let's Go Tribe regularly, because he's developed a pretty strong love for Corey Kluber and Danny Salazar this year. My guest this week is editor at FanGraphs, Carson Cistulli. Carson, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's very exciting to be here. Jason Lukart, is that how I say that?
Yes, that is right.
Yeah, thrilled is how I'm feeling about it.
Good. So I want to get to Kluber and Salazar in a second, but I'm wondering, you're editor at FanGraphs now, but unlike a lot of baseball writers, you've also got a proper Wikipedia page, and I don't know if you've looked at it, but there you are listed as American poet, essayist, and sabermetrician, which probably isn't the usual resume for someone who writes about baseball. So I'm curious a couple things. One, how you sort of got into baseball originally, and then two, is baseball, you know, most of what you write now? Do you do other writing still? So how did you get from that to FanGraphs?
Let's see. I've always been a baseball fan, and I've been a fan of, I've been a fan of other sports as well, and I've also always had, I've been very excited about keeping records. Of course, when I was at a young age, it was just anything. Like I would play, I think for Sega Genesis, there was maybe one of the early NHL games, like 91 or 92.
Sure.
I think I remember playing like an entire season with the St. Louis Blues, maybe, or maybe the Vancouver Canucks. And and essentially just like recording all of the goals and assists by hand, and then tallying them up by the end of the season, because the at that point there was really no
game didn't
no
do
hard
it for
drive.
You. Right.
Yeah, precisely. And so I suppose recording events generally has always been particularly exciting for me. And then, of course, it started for me, I guess, before Moneyball. I guess it started with Nyer. He was Rob Nyer, when he had his blog at ESPN. They introduced me to some advanced concepts or more advanced concepts in baseball analysis, and then the internet, of course, helped to expedite that relationship, that research. And so, it's probably a pretty typical path so far as that's concerned. And that's happening simultaneous to being excited about the things that words can do. And, so I was reading some good poets, and I still think that there's a great deal of compatibility, I guess, or similarity between, for example, an excellent baseball pitch, and the best poems. And I'll qualify that by saying that almost all poems are bad. So anyone who's listening, saying, "Oh, well, poems are kind of dumb," they are. Most of them are pretty bad. And until you actually read some of the better ones, and these are not necessarily the ones you'd be introduced to in grade school or even college.
Right.
Then you won't get it. But yeah, the best poems are very much like Danny Salazar's Split Change when he's throwing it at his best.
Do you do? I don't know. Either just for pleasure or on the side. Do you do much non-baseball writing these days?
Yeah. So I both in my baseball writing and my non-baseball writing, I'm very interested by the idea of brevity. And I guess how much you can get out of the fewest number of words. So this is something that works very well for blogging, obviously. I would say it's probably criticized unduly. I think that or perhaps there's a sort of blanket criticism that has to do with brevity. But brevity has been something that's been praised certainly in the past. So, for example, like Marshall and Catullus, I studied Latin. I was a Latin major in college, and Marshall and Catullus are two great early Roman poets from like first century BC, first century AD, and they valued very much brevity. And so this was the idea of being like charming and witty was highly valued, and I think that that. I think that's still a possibility. I do agree that there's a lot of nonsense on the internet too, but that's just because there's a lot of nonsense among people.
Yeah, so everywhere.
There's a pretty strong correlation between those two. So in my own like private writing or whatever, I with a friend of mine, I have a site called thenewenthusiast.com. That we just will like put up sort of aphorism size, rather short writing experiments. And sometimes we're there like twice a day, and sometimes we're not there for weeks. It's just all a question of how things are going.
Well, and I feel like Fangraphs has really turned into. I was talking to Mike Bates on here a couple of weeks ago, and he writes everywhere, but he's been writing. But I feel like Fangraphs has turned into a really diverse, between the Knot Graphs and the Beer Graphs and. I feel like there's a lot of different things coming out of there. It's not just baseball anymore, which is interesting.
Oh, go ahead, sir.
Oh, I was just going to add, what pulled you into Fangraphs? How did that come about?
Well, it seemed, let's see. I've been writing for Fangraphs for 4 years, and I've probably been reading Fangraphs for 5, I would say. One of the reasons I wanted to write for the site was because I enjoyed it quite a bit already.
Sure.
And I guess the nature of it, I think that this probably is a common principle among all of the sort of, among Fangraphs and also its sort of satellite sites, is that there's a spirit of curiosity when it's at its best or when we're at our best. And simultaneous to that, there is a need to work at the top of your intelligence always. So if you're trying to make a point, don't set up straw men to oppose it. Look for evidence. In our sort of more irreverent sort of writing, always look to get people, make people enthusiastic as opposed to. Get them excited about something, then tear down people. So I guess that's the idea. That's maybe a slightly nebulous response, but there seems to be, to me, something. These concepts seem to be associated. So let's pretend that they are.
All right, fair enough. So talking about being a kid and playing. NHL 92 or something like that. I think we must be about, I'm 33. We must be about the same age. Cause that would have been the heyday of my video game playing. So then it must have been, mid to late 80s when you became a baseball fan. Is that right?
Yeah, in fact, we are precisely the same age, it turns out, and also 33. Yes. Yeah, I would say probably my first memories of baseball are of the 1986 World Series between the Red Sox and the Mets. I grew up in New Hampshire, and my family were all very dedicated and remain so Red Sox fans. And so that series, it's one of those sorts of things, right, where I don't know if those are if I actually have memories of it or if I just have seen so many replays of it and know that I was alive then. But I do remember being aware of baseball at the time, and I remember I'm not a Mormon, but I remember that after that 86 season, I think Bruce Hurst came to the Church of the Latter-day Saints in Concord, New Hampshire, and to talk, I guess. I don't know if to convert people or not. I don't know. But my dad, who's also not a Mormon, brought me and I guess at that point a six-year-old, and we ran to the front immediately after whatever the service or talk was over, and we got Bruce Hurst's autograph. This was very important. I remember thinking it was very important to my dad, so that's what we did. And of course, Bruce Hurst was quite a good pitcher then. So that was sort of one early moment where I got the sense that whatever was happening was important. And certainly being around Boston, it's not always second nature to people who are raised in other areas, but certainly in Boston, you don't have to be a baseball fan to be a Red Sox fan. Those things are not mutually exclusive, they could be exclusive, I suppose. You could just be like I remember talking to my uncle the other day. He said he's not a big Red Sox fan, and yet he knew about Xander Bogaerts and like almost precisely when he had been promoted.
Right.
And you know, so that's like a thing. It's like you can just be around and know about Xander Bogaerts.
Yeah,
which I think
is way in.
Yeah, in other markets that may not be the case.
So, as a Red Sox fan, like I said in the intro, I mean, I think at Let's Go Tribe, at least, you've come up a pretty fair amount this year because you've written a lot and put together a lot of quick video gloops, GIFs, GIFs. I can't remember which one it's supposed to be. Anyway, of Corey Kluber and then a little later, Danny Salazar. As a Red Sox fan, are you still just kind of drawn all over the place to baseball? Do you feel like writing for Fangraphs, that's an obligation? What first pulled you towards Corey Kluber and then Danny Salazar? What was it you saw or became aware of that was appealing to you?
Yeah, well, so I should say that I was emancipated from my Red Sox fandom after the 2004 World Series. It was not a conscious decision, but it was an immense catharsis, and I was very happy after it. And I was not really ready for the season to begin in 2005. And I think just by dint of repetition, like I started, I went into the 2005 season thinking that it was going to be just like other ones, but I never really felt committed. And I haven't felt very much committed since. And then after reading the Baseball Perspectives book, Mind Game, which is well done, and it basically dissected not necessarily why the Red Sox won, although that was part of it, but also why they hadn't won for years. And at that point, I realized that I had felt manipulated because the Red Sox were never going to win when they had a sort of miserly ownership group and poorly informed front office, and then everyone was a little bit racist or more racist other times.
Right.
So I didn't like the fact that I had been perhaps manipulated, even though ultimately the payoff was pretty excellent with the Red Sox victory in 2004. So gradually, and it wasn't necessarily on purpose, but gradually I sort of became a fan of the game in a larger way, and became excited by, well-run teams. And now it's definitely to the point where individuals about whom there's something exceptional are the thing to which I'm probably most attracted. With Kluber, that's the thing that's most exciting about him is he's a 27-year-old. He's in his age 27 season.
Right.
And He'd only entered the season with 67 innings, I think. And yet this season, his defense independent marks have been crazy. His actual run prevention marks have still been above average, and not as well as his defense independent numbers, but still.
Right.
And then he also throws 95 or 93 to 95 with his two seamer. His slider, his cutter, his changeup are all excellent. And so, I guess the question that you know I'm looking to answer always with Kluber. And I don't know if he even knows, is how is something like this possible, right? I mean, you need to ask him and you need to ask, the members of the Cleveland front office and coaching staff, because it's a very rare situation. It probably happens more with pitchers than it does hitters, but still rare. And that's the thing that's drawn me to Kluber.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a couple people. He was injured in the off season for a little while, and you know, there was a little talk from at least a small segment of the Indians fan base that I know of that cared at all. And we just, oh, that's a bummer. And I think for most people, it was, who cares? He's not a part of the team really anyway, you know, in terms of someone you're looking to get contributions from. I certainly didn't expect anything like this. And you mentioned in an email that you had a chance to talk to him recently. Is that right?
Yeah, and actually, I guess so. We're talking on a Wednesday night. My guess is that this piece will go up tomorrow.
Yeah,
I was able to talk via phone with Kluber. I think I'm not sure if he was back with the team yet or if he was still doing rehab. I might have caught him sort of in between. But yeah, we talked for just about 10 minutes. And I think that, I mean, probably Cleveland fans will know this even better than I, but he's very understated and is definitely like he's living within the present moment. You know, any question I ask him would sort of encourage them to reflect on and I didn't ask it in such a douchey way, but the meaning of what he had done or, you know, even just if he was sort of aware of this sort of rarity of his particular career arc, he was not really interested in contemplating that. And there's probably, you know, if that's how he needs to do things, then that's fine.
Right.
I will say we did get into a little bit more of a back and forth with regard to and this will be the sort of bulk of the piece that goes up. Well, I asked him to help me sort of, I guess, consider or to write essentially a biography of each of his pitches. And one unique thing, and this I hadn't even known this until I talked with him, is that, you know, on the one hand, he didn't necessarily know why everything had come together for him so neatly, but on the other hand,
right,
he's added his two most frequently used pitches just within the last 2 years. His two-seamer, I think, is less than a year old, and his cutter is less than 2 years old. And, you know, he uses those pitches more frequently than he uses his other ones. So I'm guessing just integrating those in his repertoire and then learning how to command them has probably been a big difference for him.
Did he say anything about the impetus for adding those pitches, if they were suggested by someone or?
Yeah, it actually seemed like in both cases it was working with here's where I'll prove my ignorance, but with whomever the AAA pitching coaches in the Cleveland organization. I think that's what he said. Don't quote me entirely, but but it was in tandem with a pitching coach. And I don't know if that's necessarily who offers that up, but you know, it's not uncommon at all for pitchers, especially if they were in the minors or if they enter spring training, to try and add a pitch, especially someone who, like Kluber, appeared to have some physical gifts, had kind of always struck out batters, but maybe demonstrated some command and or control issues. I think it would, you know, he's going to try and get to the major leagues, and if you can just add to your repertoire and have command of different pitches or replace a pitch, because he used to throw a four-seamer pretty frequently, I guess, and he doesn't really now. I think 5% of the time, maybe less. You could see someone trying out new things until they're really successful. And he appears to have found a pretty effective combination at this point.
Yeah, I mean, on a per inning basis, he's been the team's best pitcher this year. And right now he's scheduled to come back Saturday. At one point they were going to have him, they were calling piggyback with Scott Kazmir on Friday, and I guess, you know, maybe each throw 3 or 4 innings or something. But now, last time I looked at the schedule, Kluber set for Saturday against the Mets, and then Danny Salazar is set for Sunday. So it's going to be a big weekend for those guys. You're going to be busy at Fangraphs. How about Salazar? When did he catch your eye?
Actually, Salazar caught my eye right at the beginning of the season. I write a weekly piece that comes out every Wednesday at the site, at least during the season. This was the first year I did it, and it's probably my favorite thing to write at the site, at least on the main site. And it's called The Fringe Five, Baseball's Most Compelling Fringe Prospects. Essentially, the idea is to look at those players who did not appear on any preseason top 100 lists and look at that population and which among that population, which players among that population are sort of most compelling or, you know, showing the most promise. I mean, it's a pretty broad definition, but generally speaking, it's players who are either way better than they seem to be or are effective in a weird way, like this player for St. Louis, Mike O'Neill. He's just sort of like this weird corner outfielder who never strikes out and walks 15% of the time. So he's not going to be a star, but he just has a weird skill set that I think that would appeal to, to Fangraphs readers or people who are sort of curious about that thing. But Danny Salazar showed up immediately because he
has. Can I interrupt you just to ask, because I'm curious about this? When you say he jumped up immediately, so when you're looking for guys beyond that top 100, prospects, like most baseball fans, prospects excite me because of, you know, the possibility of who knows what they might turn into. And for a team like the Indians, that's appealing. But I also, I don't have a great prospect knowledge. I mean, I know the Indian system pretty well because, you know, they're the team I cheer for and team I write about. But beyond the Indians, you know, I don't know, you know, past the teams, you know, past those top 100 prospects, what do you draw on to kind of find the guys you find? Is it talking to scouts? Is it watching video on your own?
Yeah, so the sort of first step I take is to go through all of our the minor league leaderboards, and I calculate within each of the minor leagues, I calculate essentially index stats that are based off of defense independent metrics. So for batters, it's going to be, home runs, walks, and strikeouts. And then for pitchers, it's actually just strikeouts and walks. And for pitchers, it's a regressed form of, I don't know what you call it, KWERA. I would say QUERA, but that sounds like an LGBT, like, rallying call. It's neither here nor there. But it's essentially, yeah, it's strikeouts and walks, your ERA estimator. And I produce like a, probably what is a poorly calculated regressed version of it, but that's essentially like the first layer of screening. And Danny Salazar showed up there immediately. I think he was pitching in the Eastern League with Double A. What's your Double A team there?
Akron.
Yeah, sure. He was pitching with Double A Akron.
Could have been the Carolina League, maybe. Well, in any event.
No, I think that's, yeah, Double A. Oh, okay, yeah. Is that a Carolina? In any case, wherever he was doing, he was posting excellent defense independent rates relative to the other players, other pitchers in the league. And so I said, oh, this is what I'll do is that's like my first step in the screening process. And then you sort of get together, X number of players whose numbers are impressive, but then you try and then what I do is I try and look at, which of those, you know, just sort of learn more about all those players, right? And it gets easier as the season goes on because, you know, a lot of the same players keep popping up. But I'd never heard of Danny Salazar. And then, I will look for some, you know, for pitchers, the first thing is to look at velocity readings. And I saw velocity readings of like 95 plus. And I'm like, how have I never heard of this guy? Why isn't he? You know, why isn't he all around? And then I watched with
right.
video, and I think I recorded GIFs of him at some point, or I did that a number of times, and noticed that he was you know, his split change was also pretty effective. Although that's
yeah.
It's harder to pick up sometimes in the minor league video because, you know, there's a lot of off-center cameras, and so you can't always tell the changes apart from other sorts of pitches. But he's good, is what I figured out.
Yeah, I mean, when he came up, it was, I think, early July, and he came up and pitched against Toronto in his debut. I think he pitched 6 innings, gave up 1 run on kind of a question. You know, it could have been an unearned run. Anyway, he pitched really well, a lot of strikeouts. His second struck out 10 Tigers. And like you said, it looks so good. The velocity, the movement on his off-speed stuff. And the Indians, their pitching last year was incredibly bad. And it's they haven't had a lot of great pitchers, at least in recent years. And so just to watch someone come up with his stuff with such a big change of pace, and it was incredible how excited fans were. And, you know, Trevor Bauer, who was sort of the big prospect acquisition this year that in basically a 3-way trade they gave up Shin-Soo Choo for. And so, you know, people were coming into the season, Bauer was the guy, and now he's kind of struggled this year. And not that that's been forgotten, but it doesn't feel like such a big deal because Salazar's been amazing. You know, just in terms of watching a pitch, it's such a change of pace from watching someone like, you know, Zach McAllister, who's had pretty decent results, but it just looks different. It looks like you're, you know, almost like you're watching someone do a completely different task when you see him pitch compared to a lot of guys.
Right. And then you also had, well, of course, you guys also had like, I feel like you had like 10 different pitchers, like David Huff too, who...
Oh, God, David,
you know,
Huff.
Well, yeah, but like guys who threw strikes and, but not really much else. And
yeah.
I don't know if Cleveland has necessarily had fantastic defenses in recent years either. So it's not really a great combination.
No. Yeah. And I mean, even, you know, this year, the outfield defense was expected to be great with signing Bourne and Drew Stubbs coming in and Michael Brantley moving back to left where his glove would rate as a plus. And yeah, I mean,
can I ask you about Drew Stubbs for a moment? Is, you
sure.
know, so I watch between Kluber and Salazar, I watch, you know, something like maybe 20% of Cleveland games at this point, maybe a little more. Stubbs seems like a weird fielder to me because I know that he's very athletic, but he sometimes seems to make sort of like strangely uncoordinated plays for someone with at least what I've been led to believe was a pretty good deal of athleticism. Is it possible that I'm just seeing the wrong games?
No, I think that's sort of the consensus sense is that he's a good fielder, but yeah, things don't quite look right and the results haven't been as good. I was Kevin Goldstein, who was, you know, like the big prospects guy for Baseball Prospectus for a long time and now works for the Houston Astros. I was at an event that he was speaking at, and I don't even remember how it came up, but this was before 2012, so this wasn't a long time ago, you know, a year and a half ago, and he was adamant that Drew Stubbs was the best defensive outfielder in baseball, and he was certain of it. Having watched him much more this year than at any point, I don't feel like he's a bad fielder, but he's certainly not someone I would have picked out as best in the game. And I don't know if that, you know, if he slipped since then or what.
They generally only go in one direction, and that's
right.
You know, and that's sort of like what's made the Boston's trade of Jose Iglesias to Detroit so unique is. Here's a player who's, you know, regarded widely as one of the best defensive shortstops in the game, even among major
yeah.
leaguers. But that's a skill that is really only going to go downhill. So essentially, that's what the Red Sox are betting on, is that you know, his main asset is at its peak right now, and you know, beyond that, you know, beyond his sort of strange offensive surge this year that's kind of
right.
really relying on. But, yeah, but who
yeah,
knows
I wonder,
if that's the case with Stubbs or not.
I'm sure there's, you know, a decent Google search could turn up good results. If the aging curve, you know, position by position, you know, I feel like in terms of a great shortstop, a lot of it's, I don't know if instincts is the right word, but kind of, you know, the quick first step and the ability to read the ball really quickly, and smooth glove work and transitioning the ball. I wonder if that ages better than an outfielder, or at least a little more, it's dependent on your pure speed, which is maybe going to give way before some of those other skills. I don't know. I mean, Iglesias, who I'm sure you saw a lot of for most of this season, I've seen a lot of since the trade, and he's really impressed me with his fielding. And you might be right, it might not last, but it seems like he's such a strong plus with the glove right now that...
Right. And it also probably depends on what time. Like, I know that, like, J.J. Hardy, for example, has a reputation of having, a huge arm. And,
right.
You know, perhaps it's the case that shortstops with, like, big arms, like, I think that was the case maybe with, I don't know, Tony Fernandez, maybe.
Right.
Or Sean Dunstan, I think, was also known for that. Just guys with huge arms, and they can make up for other, maybe, slight flaws in their fielding.
Right.
By being able to throw so hard, you know, Iglesias also has he's pretty good all the way around. But if there was a shortstop who, for some reason, whose arm was closer to fringe, but, you know, made up for it with, quick actions, et cetera, then, you know, maybe that would be a sort of shortstop to decline more quickly.
Right. Well, coming back to Stubbs, I can't disagree with you. There's something you can't quite put your finger on watching him that somehow feels like something's not adding up. I think he's been playing a lot more this year than expected. I think going into the season, the lineup that was envisioned, he was going to be in a much smaller platoon role. And Lonnie Chisenhall was a bust, but Mark Reynolds started really hot, but then he cooled off. And anyway, I mean, Nick Swisher's played a lot less right field than I think people anticipated for a combination of reasons. And yeah, we'll see. I don't feel great about Stubbs being an everyday player going forward into the rest of this year and, you know, more so looking at next year, but we'll see what happens. Another thing I want to talk to you about and kind of looking at next year, we're talking about Kluber and Salazar, who, fingers crossed, are going to be a part of the rotation for the foreseeable future. But the Indians have a couple other starters. Ubaldo Jimenez and Scott Kazmir are both going to be free agents after this year. Jimenez technically has a mutual option, but it's only $8 million. And the way he's pitching lately, he's going to decline that. And Masterson, who's the would-be ace of the staff, got 1 year left. I don't know how beyond Kluber and Salazar, how much you know about any of those guys. But do you have any sense of if you think a team should look to sign any of those guys or extend Masterson, or, you know, if you kind of imagine yourself as Cleveland GM, what you would think of the rotation beyond 2013?
Well, certainly having Kluber and Salazar healthy has been nice. I mean, I was just looking at those figures. Between them and Kazmir, those are, like, on a per-inning basis, those are Kazmir, Kluber, and Salazar are three of your four best pitchers. I don't know what...
Right.
I don't necessarily know what the market's going to be for Scott Kazmir. I can't imagine it's necessarily
going to be huge. I don't think so. And at Let's Go Tribe, I think it was just during a game thread one night in the last week or so, he had like three good starts in a row when he was pitching that night. And someone commented, you know, the Indians should sign him to like a 3-year, $30 million extension. And I was immediately like, there's no way Scott Kazmir is getting $30 million in guaranteed money. He's had half of a pretty solid season after basically not being in the majors. There's no way he gets something like that. I don't have a great sense of what I think he will get.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me, although please believe that I'm not an expert in this way, but it would not surprise me if he, came to some sort of deal with the Indians just because they were the team that sort of, salvaged him. I think there's probably precedent for that sort of arrangement, so it wouldn't be surprising. And he could, if at the right price, he could be worth, he's essentially on the 2-win pace this year, per two innings,
right.
So paying Scott Kazmir, giving him a, 2 year, yeah, two, I mean, 2 years, 20 wouldn't be crazy because, there's probably a good chance he'd be worth it. They may not even have to pay him that much though. I don't know if
I'd be happy to have him back. I I wouldn't go 3 for 30. I mean, I don't think anyone will. So I don't think that's really going to be the issue. You know, 1 year, $10 million. You know, fine. 2 years, 18 maybe. But I wouldn't go past that. Just he hasn't. I mean, he's been good, but not great this year. And you know, with his last 2 years, I don't have as much confidence in him. Jimenez is actually the one, and I 4 months ago wouldn't have believed I was going to be saying this, but he's the one. I mean, he's been the Indians' best pitcher in for the last 2 months. And after his 2012 and his first month or so this season, I wouldn't have believed he takes a lot of grief at Let's Go Tribe. And I think people are finally starting to semi-accept that, hey, this guy has actually been pitching pretty well for a while now.
Yeah, I don't know if – my guess is – so if I'm the GM, I'm going to probably let another team pay Jimenez the sort of money that Jimenez might be able to get on the open market. He throws so many pitches, to get through a game, just because of, you know, his lack of command. I don't think he's had a walk rate below, he's had very few below 10% and zero below 9%. So
right.
It's a bit frightening when it requires a pitcher needs that many pitches to get through a game, regardless of how well he's doing. So I feel like, you know, it's also briefly inspecting it. It seems like it's not going to be such a bad offseason in terms of, free agent pitchers. And there's sort of some interesting names out there. So I mean, I guess it depends on how many of those pitchers are signed. But, they're going to be some decent names out there that, I know like A.G. Burnett's going to be a free agent. Obviously, I mean, if he's not signed, but I think probably Matt Garza, Josh Johnson had sort of a weird season, and you might be able to get him for cheap. I don't necessarily know if Cleveland is in a position to pay the top dollar, but I feel like spending a lot on pitchers generally is not necessarily a great plan. Better to go for sort of like pitchers who've been maybe broken recently. But could show promise. I mean, like the Rays this year, I think they signed their first free agent pitcher in like a million years or something. And that was,
he's not Fausto Carmona anymore, but Roberto Hernandez. Yeah.
Right. And he's been excellent. You know, I would say copy the Rays, whatever the Rays would do. You should do that. That's my suggestion to you.
I don't know that I want the Indians to pay what I think Jimenez is going to get either. I think he'll cost more than Kazmir. In a vacuum, if it was just pick one or the other for the same amount of money next year, Jimenez is a guy I would take. But I also, Masterson's here next year. Whether he gets extended beyond that, I don't know. But he's back. Kluber and Salazar, if they're healthy, they go into the rotation. Zach McAllister is... someone I kind of feel like does it with smoke and mirrors. He doesn't blow me away with his stuff. But the results have been pretty decent for a back of the end of the rotation guy. And they've got a couple of, I feel like they could lose Kazmir and Jimenez and still end up having a pretty decent pitching staff. And they've been hit. I don't know that you would have noticed this as a non-Indians fan, but their offense has been brutal since the All-Star break. Lonnie Chisenhall was supposed to be the third baseman of the future, and he's still pretty young. I think 25 this year, but I think people have less and less confidence in him, and I don't know who's out there at third base. Anyway, the Indians, I don't think, last year they went out and got Swisher and Bourne. They're not going to have a shopping spree like that again. So I guess, kind of let the market get set and see what happens. But it's just nice that they have some interesting pitching options because they haven't for a while.
Yeah. Whatever happened to Brett Meyer? Where did Brett Myers go?
He made 3 starts. I think he pitched in relief once. I think he 4 games at the beginning of the year. I think he threw 21 innings and gave up 10 home runs, which was the highest home run rate of any pitcher in baseball history with that many innings. Pitched in the minors for most of the season, and then... they cut him loose. And apparently, it was pretty interesting. The day he was cut or designated for assignment, whatever the specific logistics of it were, there were pretty interesting tweets from a couple of Indians beat writers. I don't, you know, I can't quote any of them verbatim, but something along the lines of like, I'm not saying the clubhouse is glad he's gone, but they're certainly not sad he's gone. That kind of stuff. He apparently turned a lot of people off. He certainly didn't work out as a pitcher, and he apparently didn't work out very well as a teammate either. So he's gone, and I suppose good riddance.
Oh, so not a glowing recommendation
no.
on Brett Myers' behalf. Yeah, all right. Well, there you are.
So what do you – at this point, I feel like the Red Sox have a pretty good grip on the East, the Tigers in the Central. The West is an interesting race, and then the AL wildcard race is pretty wide open right now. What's your take on the American League for the last 3.5-4 weeks of the season? What do you envision happening?
So the way I approach any of this is mostly just I will be slavish to the playoff odds in terms of
right.
my assessment of it. I guess it's mostly like today I was excited to see and I was able to see some of it, the like the Oakland Texas game, right? So yep. I definitely like will approach these games like a spectator as opposed to an analyst.
Sure.
Because I feel like there's nothing I can necessarily offer beyond that. I mean, it's always exciting, right, when a team like Oakland is winning because they have fans that are very involved, and they have a lower payroll than you know than many of their competitors, and they all have long hair. These are all things that I can appreciate. So so in that way, I, you know, it would probably just you know, look at the playoff odds or whatever and say, yep, that's the team. So for right now, Oakland has a 63% chance to win the division. Rangers have a 37% chance. I mean, they're the only two teams with anything like a chance.
Right.
So I'm going to go with Oakland to win that. That's going to be.
And then the Rays for the second wild card.
Yeah, right. These are all my hot internet opinions.
all right. Well, then forget as an analyst, as a fan, and as someone who's drawn to excellence and maybe in interesting places. You know, players you're done. What would you, which five teams who conceivably could make it, are there teams you would prefer to see in the playoffs just aesthetically?
Well, I mean, with regard
to
so let's
AL
say,
or NL, feel free to talk about National League teams too.
Yeah, sure. So in the American League, among the three teams that are sort of on the bubble, as it were, I would like to see Tampa Bay, and Cleveland make it, and then to have Oakland win the AL West, and to
right.
have Texas out of it. I mean, this is just not that I hate Texas, but of course Tampa Bay is they really need no introduction so far as the effect that they might have on someone who's excited by teams that are well run and underpaid.
Right.
Cleveland, of course, because it would be so very cool to see Corey Kluber pitch in the playoffs. Even though he's not really aware of how great he is. And then, Oakland for the reasons that I've just mentioned. So
right.
now if we could exclude Texas, of course, no ill will towards them, but there's, you know, not the best story.
Yeah, but someone's got to be left out.
Yeah, someone's left out, yeah. And then, the thing is that I guess what's happening in the NL now, right, is like there's kind of just one thing, and that is, it's all happening in the NL Central, and that's who's
right.
going to win the division at this point. Pittsburgh is most likely, although St. Louis is not very far behind. Nor Cincinnati. It's so far as with about 2 weeks to play, I guess it's not impossible
right.
to come back from enough games. Unlikely, but not impossible. And of course, Pittsburgh winning everything would be great. Pittsburgh going to the World Series would be great because
right.
I think. They haven't been 500 for 20 years, so of course that would be exciting. St. Louis is a team that is they're so regardless of anyone's feelings for them, they have so many players who were drafted in the 10th round and after, and yet are like vital contributors to the team. They're just shocking in terms of the like the competence of their, I mean, or maybe it's luck, who knows, but it seems like it would have to be competence of their player development staff
yeah.
and system. And so, you know, it's always to see those teams rewarded for that sort of thing. It's great to see like a team of, Alan Craig's and John Jay's and, succeeding. Steve Lombardozzi's all around. No, Steve Lombard. No, it's a guy, Matt Carpenter and Steve Lombardozzi.
Matt Carpenter,
he's the guy
I knew of, but not as anything. And yeah, he's been incredible. He's been the best second baseman in baseball this year, I think.
Right. So it's just weird that they have players like that. And it's, I lived for the last 3 years in Wisconsin, and there's not a great deal of affection for the Cardinals among Brewers fans, but that hasn't worn off on me too much. I don't mind when St. Louis does well, at least not necessarily the colors, like but the actual players who are presently playing. It's a nice arrangement.
Do you, living in Wisconsin, do you end up going to a decent number of Brewers games just to go to games, or do you mostly just stay home and watch on TV?
I worked a bunch of Brewers games this year because I have the BBWAA card now, which is awesome. It's very fancy. And so I was there a bunch, and certainly when they had their playoff run a couple years ago, that was really exciting, just because anytime you're in a place and the community is excited about it, then it's hard for that not to wear off on you when you're living there. But I didn't live and die with Milwaukee at all. I have a MLB.TV subscription, and I chase the best pitching matchups generally.
Right.
Is how I watch. So I was not dyed in the wool Milwaukee fan at all. They are a small market, and when they're doing well, I think it's good. It's good.
Yeah, I mean, you're right about the fan excitement. You know, living in Chicago, when they played the Cardinals in the NLCS a couple of years ago, I randomly just picked up a ticket and drove up to Milwaukee for the first game of that series. And I'd never been to a playoff game before because I don't live in Cleveland, and, you know, when the Cubs and White Sox. I'd never been to a playoff game. I'm sure at most playoff games, if you're not in Atlanta where they can't sell out a playoff game, you know, the crowd's pretty into it. But, I mean, it was an incredible crowd. And I think in some ways probably a similar fan base to what the Indians have. So certainly I could, you know, appreciate the success they were having and feel good about it for them.
Yeah, I think that you always want to be sort of party to a spectacle. And, you know, when you feel like you can be there and witness something like that where everyone's excited and they want the team to do well, and they're happy when the team does well and the team does do well, then it's great.
Right. Well, last thing before you go, you mentioned, you talked about talking to Corey Kluber. And so is that something, is there going to be an article at Fangraphs we can look for in the near future on that?
I'm sorry, repeat that.
The Corey Kluber, the interview you had with them, will there be an article with that we can keep an eye out for?
Yeah, I think actually Thursday in the electronic pages of Fangraphs, there will be a sort of Q&A, a print Q&A, electronic print Q&A, I guess, with
great
with Kluber. So hopefully that'll be or if he's not starting till Saturday, maybe it'll go up Friday. I was figuring I would do it the day before he started, but you said he's starting Saturday now, so maybe Friday will be the day. Which would also help me to be lazy in the meantime, which is sort of one of my favorite pastimes. So there we go.
Well, Carson, thanks so much for joining me. And good luck with the rest of your baseball following this season. And I hope we get to talk again sometime soon.
Yeah, it was excellent. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Okay. Again, that was Carson Cistulli, editor at Fangraphs, and at Let's Go Tribal, we'll definitely run a link to that interview with Corey Kluber that he's got whenever it does go up, whether it's Thursday or Friday. And if you're not familiar with this stuff, you should definitely swing by Fangraphs and check it out. It's I really, you know, in terms of, he's talking about the brevity, a lot of it's really short form, but he's got the daily notes over there. And if you're an Indians fan, just go for the Corey Kluber and Danny Salazar love. Anyway, the Indians, again, they beat the Orioles tonight, taking 2-3. They are 3 games back of the Rays at the moment. And they've got a day off tomorrow, and they better enjoy it, because after that they play for 17 straight days. But it is against weaker opponents, and whether that helps or not, we'll see. But Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they're at home against the Mets. Scott Kazmir scheduled for Friday night. And then Corey Kluber's return scheduled for Saturday, and Danny Salazar on Sunday. And right now, Danny Salazar is slated to face Matt Suzaka, who the Indians cut loose after he played in Columbus all season. And he has had a rough go of it in 3 or 4 starts for the Mets so far. I'm a little surprised they still got him pitching, but maybe that's just how slim their pickings for pitching are right now. Anyway, the Mets this weekend, next week the Royals, and then to Chicago to face the White Sox. I'll probably be at the Saturday and or Sunday games in Chicago. So if you're a Chicago listener and you want to try to meet up at one of those games, just you can find my email address at Let's Go Tribe, or drop something into the comments of the podcast post, and meet up and have a beer or something at the game. Anyway, thanks for listening. And this has been episode 11 of Let's Talk Tribe. We'll talk again next week.
When you go on a long drive, the last thing you want is a problem that leads to an unexpected... ...delay to your journey. So do a few simple vehicle checks before setting off, including tires, oil, water, and fuel. Highways England.